And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Santa Cruz presentation of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up in the second half of the show, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. We're going to get right into this week's commentary, and let's see what happened to our commentary. Oh, wait a second. No, we were going to do the rest of the activist news. That's right. Here's a letter from Josh Harper. I'm a green anarchist in Eugene, Oregon, and co-producer of the Breaking Free video magazine series, and for the last few years I have been encountered federal harassment for my beliefs and activists, and it's about to get worse. A federal grand jury has convened in Portland, Oregon, to investigate actions undertaken by the Earth and Animal Liberation Fronts over a three-year period of time. My old roommate and friend Craig Rosebrough was the first to be subpoenaed and brought before these agents of oppression. Thus far, he has been lucky and remained free. Grand juries can imprison a person for up to 18 months without ever having to convict them of a crime. You have no right to an attorney in the grand jury room, and you lose your right to remain silent, a free country indeed. I was also subpoenaed to appear before the grand jury as someone who cares deeply for the earth and abhors government in any form. I cannot in good conscience testify before this or any other grand jury, and I may be jailed for this reason. I know activists have few funds to donate, and I would, of course, prefer to see money go to direct action. But for those of you who can make a small donation to help with the filing of motions to keep me out of prison, I would greatly appreciate whatever you can afford. And hey, it'll keep a few of your dollars from going to the feds, because all donations made to my defense are tax deductible. Ha ha, nice, huh? This system wants to stop us all. It doesn't care if we are masked raiders or video producers. All it wants is to protect the capital gain of the few. That is all it has ever done and all it ever will do. As warriors of the earth, we must stand together. My court date is May 24th at the federal courthouse in Portland, Oregon at 9 a.m. Please make it to the demonstration or donate a few dollars if you can. Please make checks out to the Animal Rights America and include a note stating the donation is for Josh Harper's legal defense fund. Thank you. If there's a surplus of funds after legal costs, the funds will go to direct action groups in the Northwest. Once again, send your donations to Animal Rights America, P.O. Box 469, Caldwell, New Jersey, 07006. That address again, Animal Rights America, P.O. Box 469, Caldwell, New Jersey, 07006, and again, include a note that the donation is for Josh Harper's legal defense fund. Nia Bay 8-2, the U.S. Coast Guard loses case against second macaw whale hunt activist. A jury of six men and six women took less than 2 hours to deliberate before acquitting Scott Hopper of gross negligence in the operation of a vessel, a charge stemming from his participation in water protests against the macaw whale hunt last year. This recent not guilty verdict came down after 3 days of testimony from the Coast Guard, macaw whalers, and expert witnesses at the Federal District Courthouse in Tacoma, Washington. Commander Coster of the Coast Guard was back for a repeat performance against Hopper this week, maintaining that Hopper used obscenities and swore at him over the radio and threatened him politically. Hopper denied the accusations. Another Coast Guard officer accused Hopper of transmitting unlawfully over Channel 16, maintaining that this is a private radio channel reserved for government use. And it was pointed out that he is mistaken. Channel 16 is a public marine channel. And the jury also disregarded the testimony of macaw whaling crew members Wayne Johnson and Theron Parker, who stated that Hopper hit a whale and rolled it over, interrupted the hunt on several occasions, and diverted the whaling canoe. And after viewing all the news videotape of Hopper's boat on the water, the prosecutor admitted that all these charges were obviously false. Hopper turned down all offers from the government before and during trial to take a plea. I took a stand for whales that have learned to trust us. I took on the federal government and won, and I feel pretty good, he said. And unfortunately, Cheryl Rorabeck Seiler will be tried in Tacoma this week, and the trial of Sea Chef Allison Lance has been postponed. An intrepid Moscow activist became a thorn in Idaho Senator Larry Craig's side when he came to the University of Idaho recently to speak on natural resource issues for the Bora Symposium. Several minutes after he took to the stage in the food court of the new Idaho Commons, strange things started to happen. First, a large banner tumbled off the side of one of the many balconies overlooking the court. The banner stated, "Larry Craig equals timber puppet." Then, even more shockingly, a life-size marionette made of stuffed shirt, fist-clenching money, and a shocking triangular head made of three cardboard-mounted photos of Larry's likeness came tumbling off the balcony. The marionette hung from long strings attached to a stick, and the operators made the arms and head move at will by jerking the stick. Each Larry Craig face on the puppet had been photo-engineered such that Larry's classic grin had been flipped into a nasty snarl, and each forehead was complete with a different Timber Corporation logo, which donates to Larry's campaign, Boise Cascade, Potlatch, and Bennett Lumber. Another huge banner toppled off another balcony, this one a classic vinyl job stating, "Idaho's roadless backcountry, an American legacy, a gift for the future." Larry's eyes were seen to pop as he caught a glimpse of his likeness on the puppet, but he tried his best to keep his cool throughout his speech, in which he blasted the environmental extremists which were ruining the West and the undemocratic nature of the Roadless Protection Initiative. Shortly after the banner and marionette unfurlings, the same Dr. Larry photos, this time mounted on sticks, started popping up in the audience. Approximately a dozen of the likenesses, some foreheads containing corporate logos, some containing slogans like "Extract" and "I Hate Trees," bobbed up and down during his speech, including one in the front row. He did get an unexpected round of applause when he announced in a voice filled with scorn that Clinton had designated more national monuments than any other president for a combined size of the state of Delaware. Spontaneous, prolonged applause erupted following this statement. This is brought to you by Friends of the Clearwater, the Cove Mallard Coalition, and you can reach all of them at 208-882-9755. That's 208-882-9755 up there in Moscow, Idaho. Now, let's go to our commentary. Foreign conservationists under siege. This is a New York Times editorial first published on April 1st. Some of the world's most dedicated human rights activists have started as campaigners for the environment. Ken Sarawiwa's initial cause, for example, was the devastation of the Royal Dutch Shell oil spills inflicted on Ogoni land in Nigeria's Delta region. As the dictatorship fought back, he found himself taking on a more traditional human rights battle for the rights of the Ogoni, against the burning of Delta villages and shooting of protesters, and finally against the sham judicial process that led to his execution in 1995. In many countries, environmental activists are finding that the line between their causes and human rights has been blurred. To protect the environment, they need both the right to speak out and fair enforcement of the law. Many are enduring the harassment that human rights activists have long experienced. The best-known examples are in Russia. The domestic intelligence service, the heir to KGB, has tried to silence scientists and Navy officers who documented the radioactive pollution emitted by decommissioned nuclear submarines. The service has spent years harassing Alexander Nikitin, a former Soviet submarine captain who wrote about the problem, although Mr. Nikitin apparently used entirely public sources and has been acquitted of espionage. He could still face further prosecutions. His case goes to Russia's Supreme Court later this month, and he was acquitted, by the way, in that, since this editorial has been written. Acting President Vladimir Putin has supported the crackdown on environmentalists, whom he has accused of spying for foreign countries. In other nations, the activities most likely to incur the wrath of governments or powerful groups are protests aimed at large, lucrative projects, such as oil production in Nigeria, Chad, Cameroon, and Ecuador, toxic waste dumping in Cambodia, logging in Kenya and Mexico, and new dam construction in China and India. The activists tend to emerge from the same isolated communities that suffer most from pollution. Typical is Rodolfo Montiel, a peasant who organized small farmers in rural Guerrero State, Mexico, against the clear-cutting of local forests, which has threatened their harvests and way of life. In May, he and a bystander were arrested and charged with weapons possession and drug trafficking. But Amnesty International and the Sierra Club, which have begun a joint campaign to draw attention to the persecution of environmentalists, say the two men were tortured into confessing. The arrests were part of a pattern in Guerrero. 5 years ago, 17 unarmed peasants protesting logging were shot by the state's judicial police. Another member of the peasant organization was reportedly abducted at gunpoint last month. The interest in intervention of large environmental organizations is especially helpful to rural activists who usually lack the connections enjoyed by their urban counterparts. What makes the rural activists particularly vulnerable is that they live in out-of-the-way places that happen to be rich in the very resources that governments and powerful interests hope to exploit. For that reason, they can get in the way of a lot of money. To most developing nations, the economic promise of forests, mineral deposits, or oil and gas outweighs environmental concerns. Such projects are also produce a river of graft for government officials. European and American groups like Amnesty International and the Sierra Club can also play an important supporting role. Many of the oil and gas companies, as well as the big customers for foreign timber and minerals, are based in the industrialized world. These companies, in turn, can influence how governments work with and treat environmental dissidents. The worldwide opprobrium heaped on Shell for its failure to help Mr. Sarawiwa has sensitized corporations to the public relations costs of silence. The next test is in Chad, where a consortium led by ExxonMobil is about to drill, and Cameroon, where the pipeline will lead. Amnesty International and the Sierra Club say that several people who have raised environmental concerns have been threatened and silenced, even though digging has not yet begun. And we again thank the New York Times for this editorial, first published April 1st. Well, let's get into news. We haven't done just straight news for a while, and there's plenty of it. The United States Forest Service has rolled out its new and improved Northwest Forest Pass. As the public responds will, how the public responds will, to a great measure, determine the look and feel of public lands recreation into the 21st century. I cannot overstate the importance of this new pass and the need for the public's true opinions to pay to play recreation. Quite simply, if the public accepts this pass or allows the United States Forest Service to say that the public accepts it because complaints were ineffective and not heard, then user fees are a done deal. Worse than this, if this new pass succeeds, the U.S. Forest Service Recreation Marketing Program will move ahead in their efforts to market the great outdoors and to turn recreation on our national forests into their branded products. Oh, man. I implore everyone to treat the next 5 or 6 months as if a war is being waged. At stake is the corporate takeover of nature and the Disneyfication of the wild. If you purchase a pass, you will be counted as supporting industrial-strength recreation. Don't buy the forest passes. Pacific Northwest newspapers will be filled with fee demo stories starting soon. Contact the press and let them know your thoughts. Please immediately start writing letters to the editor, to Congress, and to the U.S. Forest Service. Tell them you are not a customer when you go out into the woods and you don't want to be treated as such. Do anything you can. Finally, please be aware that legislation to extend a fee demo and or to make it permanent is currently circulating in the House Appropriations Committee, and unless those opposed to this program are heard within the next few months, commercialization of public lands recreation is a foregone conclusion. If you'd like more information, contact Wild Wilderness, 248 Northwest Wilmington Avenue, Bend, Oregon, 97701. That's Wild Wilderness, 248 Northwest Wilmington Avenue, Bend, Oregon, 97701. The phone number, 541-385-5261. That's 541-385-5261, or ssilver@wildwilderness.org. Their webpage, of course, is www.wildwilderness.org. And Scott's got a lot of great information. He'll tell you about fee demo programs gone bad and fee demo programs that are still working but ought to be shut down as soon as possible. And word has it the U.S. Forest Service is pushing extremely hard to have the fee demo program extended, and legislation is may be introduced as soon as May 15th. So once again, get those letters out about the fee demo program. All right. And the state of Missouri has declared a 2-year moratorium on all new chip mill permits. Since 1985, 120 chip mills have opened in the southeast, logging an estimated 1.2 million acres a year with very little regulation. Missouri is one of the three states undertaking its own chip mill study to be completed this summer. A 2-year multi-agency federal study is currently underway to assess sustainability in 13 states throughout the southeast. And blame design deficiencies in the process used, inadequate operating conditions, and bad weather for the spill from the Baia-Mare mine tailings pond, which released up to 100 tons of cyanide into Romanian, Hungarian, and Yugoslavian rivers January 30th. That's the conclusion of a United Nations investigation into the disaster. The facility had been wrongly classified by Romanian authorities as one that needed no special monitoring or contingency plan, said the report. The dam that broke on the Bayamare Mine Tailings Recovery Facility was half owned by Australia's Esmeralda Explorations and half by the Romanian state mining company, Remen. The plant was assessed as being of regular risk on the basis of a description of the plant as a closed loop that would not leak any cyanides during the treating of tailings to recover precious metals. But the facility was in fact open at two points and allowed unspecified and unmonitored amounts of cyanide to be routinely leaked into the air and groundwater even before the dam was breached, the UN report says. That spill affected the Lupus, the Somes, the Tisza, and the Danube rivers and occurred when wastewater in a reservoir breached a retention dam at the gold and silver producing plant. It killed virtually all aquatic life in the Hungary's upper Tisza River. And the National Park Service has announced new rules intended to reduce the impact of personal watercraft use in the national park system. Still, some environmentalists say the regulations do not go far enough to protect waterways from pollution and damage caused by jet skis and other watercraft. The final rule prohibits the use of personal watercraft in national park areas, except where the Park Service determines that this type of water-based recreation activity is appropriate for a specific park. And such decisions would be based on the legislation creating the park or recreational area, the area's resources and values, other visitor uses, and overall management objectives. A number of areas will now close to personal watercraft as a result of this new rule. These include six national parks: Biscayne, Florida; Isle Royale, Michigan; Glacier, Montana; Olympic in Washington; Grand Canyon in Arizona; and Canyonlands in Utah. And the closure list also includes two national seashores, that's Cape Canaveral in Florida and Cape Hatteras in North Carolina, two national lakeshores, the Apostle Islands in Wisconsin and Sleeping Bear Dunes in Michigan, and the Golden Gate National Recreation Area in California and the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway in Wisconsin and Minnesota. All right. Environmentalists say personal watercraft use is never appropriate within the national park system. And the National Park Conservation Association and the Blue Water Network believe that personal watercraft should not be used at all in the national park system because their fundamental design and purpose is for aggressive, high-speed excitement that has nothing to do with the appreciation of park resources. And the Assateague Park officials plan to ban jet skis. Park officials at the Assateague National Seashore are proposing a complete prohibition on personal watercraft use within the park boundaries. Located a short driving distance to Ocean City, Maryland, the barrier island of Assateague is the home of the Assateague and Chincoteague National Parks. Friends of the Earth is asking for citizen support for the park officials, noting that the move is likely to be contentious. Do what you can. Snowmobiles are soon to be kept out of many American national parks. Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Donald Berry, with National Parks Service Deputy Director Dennis Galvin, said they will detail measures that the National Park Service will take to halt the escalating recreational use of snowmobiles in units of the national park system. Well, that's good. Snowmobiles are bad. Uncle Dennis knows. He wrote an environmental impact study on snowmobiles in Yosemite National Park. And new limits on air tours over the Grand Canyon promise to greatly reduce aircraft noise pollution in one of America's most popular national parks. President Bill Clinton and the Federal Aviation Administration announced rules that aim to restore the natural quiet of the Grand Canyon while still allowing visitors a chance to view the canyon from the air. The new regulations from the FAA will bring the park closer to achieving a goal of substantial restoration of natural quiet congressionally mandated in the 1987 National Parks Overflights Act. It's only taken 13 years to enforce, huh? There may be no place on Earth more stunning than the Grand Canyon, said President Clinton. It's important to preserve and protect it so the millions of visitors each year can enjoy the canyon in all its splendor. And 23 tour companies of the Grand Canyon Air Tour Council annually fly 800,000 tourists over the Grand Canyon for prices ranging from $99 and up. The new rules will limit noise by expanding flight-free zones over the park and by restricting the future growth of commercial air tour operations. And national park lands throughout the country have been designated by Congress as Class 1 areas, which merit the highest air quality protection. This applies to Joshua Tree National Park just like any other, but the California Air Resources Board is conveniently ignoring this provision of the law. The board voted recently on the status of regional air quality throughout the state and refused to categorize the park as a non-attainment area, which would have meant the air quality in the park did not meet the Class 1 standards for air pollutants. This flies in the face of several years of data and studies that indicate the Joshua Tree suffers from ozone pollution levels that are well above federal standards. Citing significant damage to soils, vegetation, and other resources, the Bureau of Land Management announced it will restrict motorized travel in wilderness study areas of the San Rafael Swell region of Utah. The emergency closure order will restrict all such travel on public lands in 7 wilderness study areas, with the exception of 4 identified vehicle ways. Price Field Office Manager Dick Manis traces the majority of the problems to cross-country travel and vehicle play by all-terrain vehicles. Hill climbing is tracking around popular campsites and in the backcountry is causing soil erosion and trampling of vegetation to a degree that natural values have been compromised. And if you want to look at the federal closure, it is available at www.access.gpo.gov/SU_docs/FedReg/, and here's the important part, A000321C.html. Once again, that web page, www.access.gpo.gov/SU_docs/FedReg/A000321C. .html and look under Land Management Bureau for that information. And in spite of pending legislation that may block implementation of the Dear Mom timber sale, the Medford District Bureau of Land of the Bureau of Land Management has approved a plan of logging operations and cutting that is scheduled to begin immediately. Several environmental groups have filed suit against the BLM and the Forest Service, charging the survey and manage provisions of the Northwest Forest Plan have not been followed on numerous timber sales, including Deer Mom. Under survey and manage, the agencies must survey for rare animal and plant species. And if you'd like more information on this, you can contact KSWC, Klamath Siskiyou Wildland Center. Their number 541-846-9273. Once again, that's 541-846-9273. That's just about all the time we have for news here on Earth First Radio for this week. If you'd like to get news and announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, please send us email. Our email address is cruzef@cruzio.com. That's cruzef@cruzio.com. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Our address again, Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And please, please, please be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance so that I can get them on the air in a timely manner for you. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Once again, that's the Earth First Journal. You can find them at P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. And you can listen to Earth First Radio on your computer. We're on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio, followed by the number 4, followed by all.net. You'll need a sound card in your computer, but the software you need to play the MP3 files is free on the website, and of course Free Radio Santa Cruz is now live streaming on the web, so you could possibly hear me at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC at 8 o'clock every Thursday evening Pacific Daylight Time. And Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations, such as WXXE in Syracuse, New York. Please ask your local station to broadcast Earth First Radio. That program is broadcast on Saturday evenings at 5 o'clock in Syracuse. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney off the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. Now we're going to listen to some Judy Berry talking about what the FBI did with her fiddle.
They said the reason they knew that the bomb was in the back seat where we could have seen it rather than hidden under my seat, as it actually was, is because they said that I had loaded my guitar case right on top of the bomb, and they said the guitar and the fiddle were both like right in the vicinity of the explosion. So lo and behold, we get back the pictures from the Oakland police, and here's the guitar. Now, it's certainly damaged, but not as if a bomb had been on top of it, and there's the fiddle, virtually intact, okay? And I want you to know, I've actually seen these things in the course of the case. We get to, like, look at the evidence, and it's actually really kind of sad. This was my childhood violin, and I opened the case, and it only had two cracks up the F-holes, and that's all, whereas the guitar, which was in a cheap case, was kind of shattered. But at any rate, so in light of this, realizing that they took this fiddle, we wrote this song. Well, I was driving out of Oakland on a tour for Redwood Summer when a bomb went off inside my car. It was a major bummer. They blamed me for the bomb that almost took my life. But there's one last thing that they did, one last twist of the knife. The FBI stole my fiddle.
They stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my
fiddle. So sing along. The FBI stole my fiddle. And I want my fiddle back. The next day in the papers, although it made no sense, was a picture of my fiddle, and they called it evidence. They took away my Birkenstocks, they took away my car. But when they took my fiddle, well, you know they went too far. The FBI stole my fiddle.
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 William Sessions stole my fiddle. And I want my fiddle back. Strings was fuses, my bow it was the light, and down inside my fiddle hole I stashed my dynamite. So when I stroke my fuse strings with my fiddle bow, you better run for cover, cause this fiddle might just blow. The FBI stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle. J. Edgar Hoover stole my fiddle. And I want my back. Well, Special Agent Richard Held is the man behind the show. He helped frame Leonard Peltier and jail Geronimo. He falsified the evidence, life sentences, no bail. It's time to get them freed and let's put Richard Held in jail. The FBI stole my fiddle.
Held stole my fiddle.
And I want my fiddle back. Now Lewis Freeze got my fiddle. And I want my fiddle back. The FBI stole.